This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, Lulu here. Whether we are romping through science, music, politics, technology, or feelings, we seek to leave you seeing the world anew. Radiolab adventures right on the edge of what we think we know, wherever you get podcasts.
From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Micah Loewinger. At time of recording, the hostage swap ceasefire in Israel and Palestine has ended. Because, says Israel, Hamas violated the truce by firing rockets. Because, says Hamas, Israel began moving troops after refusing to release more prisoners. Because, says Israel, Hamas was still withholding women after promising not to. And so it goes.
Once again, explosions are rocking Gaza and giant plumes of smoke are rising over that skyline.
Amid growing outrage over a soaring death toll, almost 15,000 killed, mostly civilians, in less than 2 months, according to the Hamas-controlled Ministry of Health in Gaza.
Meanwhile, the war for public opinion rages unabated as government officials, celebrities, academics, and advocates reach for the heaviest words they can muster.
Hamas will pay for its crimes against humanity. Hamas will pay for slaughtering our people.
War crimes do not constitute and are not an appropriate response for other war crimes.
Pope Francis is facing backlash over his remarks at the Vatican, and he said the conflict had gone beyond war to become what he calls terrorism.
The city of Richmond has become the first city in the country to adopt a resolution condemning the nation of Israel, accusing it of ethnic cleansing in Gaza during its war with Hamas.
The conversations in the press and social media have slowly become dominated by one word, the crime of all crimes.
We are genocide supporters. You are not welcome here. Genocide supporters.
That's a man confronting CNN's Sarah Sidner reporting in the West Bank on October 20th, a time when genocide, to describe the civilian deaths in Gaza, was still a rare word on the network's airwaves. But as the death toll grew, so too have the protests, in part aimed at pushing the term into media coverage.
New York Times Magazine's award-winning writer Jasmine Hughes resigned after signing an open letter condemning Israel's genocide in Gaza. The move constituted a violation of newsroom policy.
The director of the New York High Office of the High Commissioner for Human Rights resigning over the UN's response to the situation in Gaza, which he described as a, quote, textbook case of genocide.
The G word, yes, genocide. And it's that word, that term, that explosive accusation that we can't shy away from examining. And look, it's not a word we should take lightly either. It's one of the worst crimes known to humankind. It's what the Jewish people were subjected to in the Holocaust.
The memory of the Holocaust, as MSNBC's Mehdi Hassan acknowledged last month, may help explain why members of the news media were initially reluctant to apply genocide to Israel's actions. Now, the word is everywhere. In opinion pages, primetime chat shows, and protest chants, and not just to describe the destruction in Gaza.
Hamas attack on October 7 is probably a genocide.
You can't ignore Hamas's genocidal tendencies, especially towards the state of Israel. They've been very open and very clear about it since they were formed in 1988, in which their charter calls for the obliteration of the state of Israel.
Hamas wants to kill Jews and drink their blood out of a boot.
Louisiana Republican John Kennedy speaking Wednesday on the Senate floor.
President Biden needs to show the world that the United States of America will continue to stand with Israel until Hamas's genocidal agenda is abandoned.
Genocide Joe has got to go! Genocide Joe has got to go!
At
protesters here in D.C. and New York, across the country. They've settled on a nickname for the president. They've been calling him Genocide Joe. Do you have a response from the White House?
We're not worried about nicknames and bumper stickers. I mean,
John Kirby, a spokesperson for the National Security Council, speaking at the White House in November.
But this word genocide is getting thrown around in a pretty inappropriate way by lots of different folks.
Beyond its cultural and political implications, genocide has legal ones, with strict criteria observed by international courts. Ernesto Verdeja is the executive director of the Institute for the Study of Genocide and a professor of peace studies and global politics at the University of Notre Dame. He says to understand whether genocide applies to violence in Palestine or Israel, we need to begin with its origins.
The term genocide itself actually has its origins in the 1940s, when a jurist named Raphael Lemkin coined the term to try to really get at a particular type of mass atrocity, which is the targeting of civilian groups for their own destruction. And genocide gets developed in a United Nations Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide in the early 1950s.
And how does the United Nations define it exactly?
As any of the following acts: committed with the intent to destroy, in whole or in part, a national, ethnic, racial, or religious group. Civilians have to be targeted based on one of those characteristics. And there are a whole set of different actions that can qualify: killing members of the group, causing serious bodily or mental harm to members of the group, inflicting on the group conditions of life calculated to bring about its physical destruction, as well as imposing measures intended to prevent births within the group, so basically preventing the reproduction of the group over time. And then finally, the forcible transfer of children from one group to another. The idea being here that over time, this destroys the integrity of the group as such. The challenge is the intention part.
How do you prove intention?
It's not enough to say that they carried out mass killings, that they created conditions bringing about the destruction of the group, such as famine or et cetera, but rather that through those actions, they intended to bring about a genocidal outcome. I will add that for many scholars who are social scientists like me and many other analysts, we actually find that definition of intention to be too constraining, too restrictive, and in ongoing atrocities, too hard to prove.
Well, can you give an example of something that you feel should have met the high bar of genocide, but could not clear it because of this definition?
So one example is what many scholars consider to be the genocide in Darfur, Sudan. There was a special investigative committee put together by the UN. The United Nations investigated it. They had a group of lawyers, very high profile and very respected lawyers, who investigated the violence carried out against the civilian populations in Darfur, committed by the government and their proxy forces. And they found that there wasn't a satisfactory evidence of the intent to destroy the civilian groups as such. However, many social scientists essentially find that what happened in Sudan against the Darfuri populations was effectively genocide.
And the U.S. government effectively took that position too, right? It wasn't just the wonks.
Correct. But again, one would have to prove that the leadership of Sudan intended to carry out the destruction of the civilian population in whole or in part. And their argument was that there was no evident plan. If I may add one point to that, genocide is not simply a thing that one identifies. One day it's not genocide and one day it is genocide. Instead, genocide tends to emerge under conditions of enormous insecurity when perpetrators feel that their prior policies have been unsatisfactory to achieve their goals. So they amp up the violence, they expand the targeting, they continue to dehumanize opponent civilian populations, and they treat them as an existential threat. Genocide is a process. It emerges often over time. And the reason why that matters is because it's rare to find a pre-existing plan of extermination, and then later it's implemented. Instead, it kind of happens in stages.
I just want to ask you outright, do you think that the Israeli Defense Forces' military action in Gaza could be legally deemed genocide?
I believe Israel is on the brink of genocide, what they're doing in Gaza. Proving it in a court of law would be difficult because it's difficult to see whether what we're seeing carried out right now reflects something like an increasing coordinated plan to destroy a part of the Gazan Palestinian civilian population as such. Again, if we were to use the legal definition, I think there's no doubt that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Forces, have carried out widespread war crimes and crimes against humanity. I think it is very difficult to take seriously the IDF's claim of considering proportionality.
Wait, what do you mean by that?
They're willing to accept a high number of civilian deaths and mutilations of Gazans in order to achieve narrow military aims. A lot of it hinges on the indiscriminate use of bombing and airstrikes, the fact that they put Gaza under siege, restricting access to food, to water, to electricity, medical aid, that they've used weapons which are banned in international law.
Like white phosphorus?
Like white phosphorus, exactly.
When Israel bombs densely populated parts of Gaza, they often say, well, Hamas uses civilians as human shields. This has been their justification.
That's correct, but that is not a sufficient justification to kill very large numbers of civilians.
You've said that it would be hard to prove intention, but members of the news media and other genocide experts, including a prolific scholar of the Holocaust, Omer Bartov, have pointed to a series of public statements from Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, members of his cabinet, and members of the Israeli parliament. On October 28th, Netanyahu referred to the Old Testament, Deuteronomy, when he said, "You may remember what Amalek did to you."
That's right. You must remember what Amalek did to you.
Referring to a line in the Bible justifying the slaughtering of men and women, infants and sucklings. On October 9th, Israeli defense minister said, "We are fighting human animals and we are acting accordingly." And the next day, as Bartov has written about, the Israeli army's coordinator of government activities in the territory, a major, addressed the population of Gaza in Arabic, saying, "Human animals must be treated as such. There will be no electricity and no water. There will be only destruction. You wanted hell, you will get hell." It's my understanding that what would make this hard to prove as genocide in international court is whether this all qualifies as intent. Why, in your mind, would this not qualify as intent?
Let me kind of take a step back here. I want to emphasize that for the vast majority of scholars working on this topic and following this case, the debate is actually quite narrow. The debate is over whether genocide is happening or whether it's about to happen. It's very, very narrow. It's an issue of kind of parsing out these different statements as starting to coalesce into a behavior that seems like a concerted set of plans of the destruction of the civilian population in whole or in part. Now, obviously, some people are outliers and they'll say IDF is not carrying out genocide. That's not even on the table. This is offensive, etc. But behaviorally, and also a lot of the language coming out of the leadership and members of government, it's clearly pointing in that direction.
The threat of genocide has been invoked by both Israel and by Hamas. For instance, if we go back to October 7th, the day that Hamas killed some 1,200 Israelis, many of them civilians, that was seen as a heinous action stemming from Hamas's stated goals to commit genocide on Israeli Jews. So under the framework that you've laid out, how should we define that day?
The October 7th assaults are war crimes and crimes against humanity. I think that would be recognized as such in a court. Hamas has often used genocidal discourse, especially its leaders. They don't draw distinctions between the state of Israel and Jews. Often it's about talking about Jewish people as essentially enemies, as threats. It's a kind of a genocidal discourse. Hamas has used genocidal discourse before the attacks on October 7th. At least some scholars refer to them sometimes as genocidal massacres. That's language that goes back to the 1980s, roughly, from an earlier pioneering scholar of genocide studies. This idea means massacres that themselves have a kind of a logic, an intentionality of genocide built into them. But Hamas, for instance, is not capable of carrying out a sustained, widespread genocidal campaign against Israel. That doesn't let Hamas leaders off the hook for using genocidal discourse. It just means it doesn't have the capacity to do so.
What Israelis see as the existential threat of Hamas is not simply that it has vowed to continue these attacks. It's that the group seems to want Iran, Hezbollah, and other Iranian-backed groups to kind of jump in and add firepower to this war, and that this is considered to be part of the looming threat that Hamas poses.
There's two ways of thinking about this, right? One is to say, well, because of that logic, that's a justification for the continued attacks in Gaza on civilian populations. If that's what it takes to destroy Hamas, then that's what you have to do. Another way to read it, though, I think is a little bit different. And that is to say, well, if Israel continues to carry this out, groups like Hamas and other extremist groups will continue to be emboldened and will continue to be supported. And effectively, what you have is a spiral of violence. It's not going to solve the security problem. This is what we, as political scientists, actually often refer to as a security dilemma. A problem is something that has a solution to it. A dilemma is something where an action may seem rational on its own terms, but the outcome itself is highly irrational. So the rational thing to do is arm yourself more and use more violence to destroy the enemy. Well, the enemy is using the exact same logic, right? And it's being supported by external actors, whether it's the US or Iran or whomever. You come out with a dilemma because you come out with an outcome of just increased insecurity, more and more killing, more and more maiming, more and more suffering. So I tend to see this kind of logic not as something that serves as a justification for massive violence, but rather as a dead end. And this is precisely why we need another logic to replace it.
The Anti-Defamation League has stated that charges of genocide or ethnic cleansing or cultural genocide do not apply to the massive death tolls in Gaza, and that even invoking those terms cheapens them, and it does a disservice to the memory of the Holocaust, the Armenian genocide, the Rwandan genocide. What do you make of that position?
I would say that it does not cheapen those histories. We are obligated to remember the Holocaust and the Armenian genocide and the Rwandan genocide and all of these other awful cases. But we also should not create hierarchies of victims. We should not say that, well, some civilians should be remembered and other civilian deaths and catastrophes and genocides, they don't have the same moral status. I think that's wrong. I don't think it cheapens it. If we take seriously ethics and morality, if we take seriously the idea of human rights as universal rights, we have to call out these atrocities wherever they happen and whoever commits them. I do want to emphasize, and this is an important point, there's an enormous amount of anti-Semitism floating around in these debates, right? There's absolutely no doubt about that. And this is what makes the political discourse, and this is why the media are so important. It's necessary to have spaces where we can disentangle these different types of charges and these different types of claims so we can really condemn anti-Semitism when it's happening, but also realize that Gazan civilian deaths, that needs to be recognized.
The Anti-Defamation League's perspective on this is that a disproportionate amount of scrutiny is placed on Israel as opposed to other humanitarian crises that are taking place. And if I'm reading into it, that's what makes it anti-Semitic, that the actions of a Jewish state are held to a different standard.
Well, I think the actions of a Jewish state should be held to the standards of international law, right? I think it's correct that there's an enormous amount of attention placed on Israel. I think that's absolutely right. I would make two further points. One is that condemning the behavior of the Israeli state is not categorically condemning all Jews. And we know that because over this past calendar year, we've seen massive mobilization against the Israeli state by Israeli Jews, right? So I would push back on this idea that condemning the behavior of the Israeli state and the Israeli armed forces somehow is, by definition, categorically a condemnation of Jews. I think that's wrong. But more generally, we don't pay enough attention to atrocities committed in other countries. Who among us still talks about the treatment of the Rohingya in Myanmar? Well, only people who focus on that. Who among us focuses on the treatment of people in Tigray, in Ethiopia? We don't talk about it. We don't talk about Yemen anymore. We don't talk about Central African Republic. I think it's absolutely right. We should be focusing on these other cases. Powerful leaders in the West don't focus on them because they're not of geostrategic interest. That's what it comes down to.
What role does the media play here? On November 9th, there was an open letter published, some 1,500 members of the media signed it, advocating for news professionals to start using terms like genocide. The way we see it now in the press is quoted from experts like you, from advocates. Mm-hmm. It is not a normative statement. It is not used plainly in news copy. Should the press use it?
I think the press should absolutely play a central role in talking about what the limitations are with a legal definition. Part of the reason why we see so many arguments and debates, and you see people not using the term sometimes or in other times using the term, is because the legal definition is so deficient. And you have different groups talking at cross purposes. You have legal specialists using the definition of genocide, which is very different from what activists and advocates might use, which is different from what policy analysts might use, which is different from what scholars might use, and et cetera, on and on and on. We end up getting caught in a particular logic of debate, which is, I call something genocide, and if you don't agree with me, and if you say it's not really genocide, it's this, this, and this, then automatically you become a genocide denier. Or if you use the term genocide, then somehow you are an enabler of terrorism.
You've called it a Rorschach test.
Perhaps I should have said a litmus test in some respect. It's a Rorschach test in the sense that you see in it whatever you want. And it's a litmus test in the sense that if one doesn't agree with one's own evaluation or assessment, then one clearly is a defender of terrible atrocities. I feel that the focus on whether what is happening is genocide or not draws attention away from how to think through of ending the violence and addressing the root causes of the violence.
Ernesto, thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Ernesto Verdeja is an associate professor of peace studies and global politics at the University of Notre Dame.
Coming up, what does the boardroom drama over Sam Altman and OpenAI actually mean for the future of the human race? Anyone? Anyone?
This is On the Media.